The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest on the program today is Yolanda York from the Social Security Administration with some late-breaking changes that are extremely important, especially if you have registered for Medicare but have not started taking Social Security benefits. You need to hear this program. Well, Jim, I think we've learned the lesson that when we're on vacation, well, actually, as far as vacation goes, don't take August off. We learned that bad things happen. While we were away, the stock market suffered its first 10% correction since the summer of 2011, which, by the way, is going to be the subject of today's show on Lifetime Income, avoiding making decisions from the position of being in a state of fear or greed. You want to avoid letting your emotions control your investment decisions. And that takes a certain amount of intestinal fortitude when everybody else is panicking. So that's why it's important not to do that. Know what you're investing in. Know how to stand in those positions. And don't let temporary corrections where it looks like briefly the sky is falling control your investment decisions, because this could be really hazardous to your health. And remember, as well, the media will play up any kind of episode that goes on in the markets around the world, and they keep you going from cliffhanger to cliffhanger to keep you on the edge of the seat. If it bleeds, it leads. I mean, that's just the way it is in the news business right now. And most of the news channels have succeeded in taking a 10-minute newscast and converting it into a 24-hour event. It's the same thing all day. And you tend to get influenced by that. People panic. What this is doing, by the way, is over-dramatizing what's going on, and it's causing rather negative effects upon people who believe it. So let's get into the nitty-gritty of what just happened. We have to look at this as a real-life example of why you need to make a plan and keep to the plan, regardless of some of the ups and downs that you're going to meet along the way. So what actually happened here, Jim?
Well, it probably began, John, when China surprised the markets by devaluation of its currency. But to put that in perspective, you got to understand the Chinese yuan appreciated against the dollar by almost 29% in the last decade. So they devalued the currency about 3%. Then that was followed by dovish statements in the Fed's minutes from their last FOMC meeting. And that triggered a chain reaction that fed on itself. By the time it was done, the market was down about 12.5% from its May high. The last time we saw anything like this in the corrective mode was back in the summer of 2011, John. And you remember what was going on? Gosh, we had, thinking back, it began with Fukushima. We had the Arab Spring, the spike in oil over $100 a barrel, the pig crisis in Europe. Then we had the debt ceiling debate. The U.S. was going to default on its debt. Well, that was a major correction during the summer of that year. And, you know, I look at what's going on right now, and we have similar cross currents as we did in 2011 as we have today. And corrections, by the way, of 10% or more are a normal part of a bull market. They're healthy. They're part of every single market cycle. The difference, I guess, right now, which has surprised a lot of investors with complacency, it's been about 4 years since we had a correction of this magnitude.
All right. So everyone was yelling that the sky is falling. The bears were all yelling, this is it. Here she blows and we're going down. But you don't think this is the beginning of something more ominous like a new bear market? This was a correction.
I don't believe so. I mean, the economic data we're receiving tells me a different story. I mean, the ISM service index is at a 10-year high. We have housing rebounding at its strongest level since 2006. You just had 4 back-to-back months of strong auto sales, the best automobile sales since going back to 2006 as well. We're running basically at an annual sales rate of over 17 million. These are not signs of an economy heading towards recession. That's not to say you couldn't have a bear market, but, you know, going back to World War II, 75% of all bear markets have occurred during recessions. Now, I'm not saying we can't have one, but it's highly unlikely. I mean, we have economic growth growing at over 3%. Second quarter was just revised up to 3.7. Housing is very strong right now. Auto sales are very strong right now. Retail is strong. The service sector is doing well. So, John, the odds of a recession are very remote at this point.
All right, so you're not worried at this point or alarmed at what you see when, say, for example, the market drops by 10% or more. We took another couple of hiccups last week that people were saying, oh, there it goes again.
You know, I actually like corrections because the companies I want to buy, they get cheaper, which means I can buy more shares cheaply. I can get a higher dividend yield and own more shares of my favorite companies. And John, the markets always are worrying about something. I mean, 2 months ago, we were worried about Greece. And before Greece, we were worried about Ebola. Well, now the greatest worry is China. And I guarantee you next year or at the end of the year or the first quarter of next year, we're going to be worried about something else. And I can't think of a single year since this bull market began and the economy moved out of a recession in the second quarter of 2009, that we didn't have something to worry about. I mean, I guess if there is a worry, what worries me is what I see investors doing to themselves. They're panicking, they're selling everything, going to cash based on fear, and they are damaging themselves financially, harming their financial well-being, and putting their personal finances at risk more than they realize.
Okay, explain what you mean by that. I mean, how are they actually damaging themselves financially? It's one thing to hear all the news, it's another to act on it.
Well, what I've seen investors, and we've seen them, we've received emails, and I've seen this happen every single year, is they react to a crisis out of fear. And instead of maybe, you know, you might want to trim some of your portfolio if you have tremendous gains and the market has a run-up. But what they do is they sell out their positions and they go either to cash or worse, they've gone into gold on the premise the dollar's going to collapse, the market's going to collapse, the economy is going to collapse, and they panic with the news and they make a decision. It's like instead of looking at something rationally, they're making these decisions out of fear rather than a rational analysis of the facts. I mean, John, how many crises have we discussed here in this recovery over the last 7 years? They've all come and gone. So even in bull markets, you're going to have events, you're going to have crises, and you're going to have corrections. The key is the economy. A healthy economy or one that's growing can handle a crisis better than when an economy is in a recession. Because when you're in a recession, anything that happens that's bad or a crisis gets magnified because the economy is contracting. So it makes it worse. And that's why a healthier economy can absorb the crises. And some of them have been media driven more than anything else, like the debt ceiling debate or the sequester or the default on U.S. debt. Anybody that looked at income tax revenues that the government was taking in knows very well the government was going to default on its debt. But that's not the way it was presented to the public by the media. It was like the U.S. was going to collapse. We were going to default on all our debt payments, which was just basically balderdash.
All right, so where does the financial damage part come in? Because what are the effects of these actions? The economy's still growing. It's actually gotten stronger. The dollar's holding up. And most of our technicians on the show, for the most part, think this is nothing more than a correction.
The damage, I think, more than anything else, is psychological. And the financial problem is when investors panic and cash in their investments because there are tax consequences to contend with. And depending on tax rates, they range anywhere from 15 to 50%, depending on your tax bracket, the state you live in, and whether your gains are short-term or long-term. So investors have to deal with a real financial correction in the form of income taxes. And John, unlike markets that can drop and then rally back, the income tax correction is permanent. The money you're going to pay for taxes doesn't get returned or refunded. It's a permanent loss. And then you have to deal with, okay, you just sold everything you got out. What do you do next? Are you going to sit in cash for at 0% and wait for the next crisis? Chances are probably, in most cases, you'll never get back in. Because what happens, and we saw this even in the steep decline that we saw that occurred in a week, when the market bounces back, what happens is everything is higher now. So you become more afraid to get back in because the stock prices are now higher. So you have to pay more for what you just sold, and you have less money because you're going to have to pay income taxes. So the higher the market goes, the more reluctant you become psychologically to get back in, because you even have greater fears of experiencing bigger losses. So you never get back in. You've seen it, and you've talked to people about it. I've come across more individuals that have been out of this market since 2011, when we had the last 10% plus correction. I mean, think of the damage to their net worth of remaining in cash or sitting on the sidelines. You should never make these decisions from a position of fear, because the financial results are going to be damaging and long-lasting, whether it's the loss that you're going to incur from paying federal income taxes and state income taxes, not to mention the fact the gains that you have foregone and the fact that you are missing out on returns. I mean, the stock market bottomed in March of 2009 at 666 on the S&P, and even with this correction on the day we're doing this broadcast, you know, the S&P is at 1900. So you've had a threefold increase in the S&P. So think of what that has meant to a lot of people that have not participated in that, in terms of what it's done to their net worth, or worse, the income that they have foregone. And unlike previous bear markets, where, let's say, back in 2000, when the tech bubble burst, at least you could go into money market funds, you could go into cash, and you're at least getting compensated 5 or 6%. Since 2009, you've been making 0%. And that's what has really set back a lot of retirees, or those getting near retirement don't have the net worth they thought they were going to have as a result of the bull market. But some of these decisions to get out and panic have prevented their net worths from gaining traction and building a net worth that could support a retirement lifestyle. So it's very, very damaging, because what they're doing is they're basically not participating in growing their net worth or growing their income, which is what you need to keep pace with inflation, especially the longer term effects of retirement when you run into more medical expenses in your latter years.
Well, they say forewarned is forearmed. How do you avoid making those mistakes? I mean, you read a lot of heavy material that at times can be quite scary. That's what you do. And I remember you had warnings of a financial crisis. Remember that before the crisis hit? We started, I think, as early as 2004 talking about the onrushing crisis. We talked about them on the program, and you wrote about them long before they came to pass. So how do you avoid making those mistakes so that you're not running with the herd, that you're not panicking, that you understand what's happening? A lot of people don't have the time to read as much of that material.
You know, what we try to do, and I think any money manager worth his salt tries to do this, you have to remain disciplined. I mean, we follow our models. We talk about them on this show, the weekend show, quite a bit. We follow our leading economic indicators. We have 19 here domestically and about 4 or 5 internationally. We have a financial stress index, because watching what's occurring in the bond market is your key to any crisis in terms of its severity, whether it's real or not real. We have a recession indicator. And of course, there's technical indicators. We have technicians on the weekend program. It's a signature part of the first hour. And in the month of August, some of those things were turning over and we raised some cash. But John, we would never, ever go 100% to cash. I mean, we scale in the market, we scale out of the market, and always keep a core position, because there's a fallacy to market timing. I frankly don't think I'm smart enough to do it, nor have I met in my 35-year career anyone who has done it consistently over a long time. And what you want to do in good portfolio management is you diversify. You keep your core positions. I'm more interested in the long-term trend and making sure I stay aboard that trend and then exit that trend when it ends. Like, for example, commodities were the big trend in emerging markets in the last decade. That trend ended in 2011. And we've been in a disinflationary environment. Gold has gone from 1900 all the way down to below 1100. Silver has gone from 50 down to 14. And emerging markets have been hit hard. The crisis we're talking about right now is the leader of the emerging markets, which is China's economy. And if you look at what has happened in this decade, something we've been preaching, it's been about blue chip stocks, the U.S. economy, and the dollar. And that has been the longer term trend. So I think it's more important to stay aligned with the longer term trend than it is to panic or try to move in and out on any short term crisis fluctuation that may occur in the interim.
Okay, let's move that to practical advice then, because when we talk about avoiding mistakes, I always like to create for people checklists of things. You know, in this situation, do A, B, C, D first, and you do it like that way. What practical advice would you give to investors how to avoid making emotional mistakes and to avoiding these pitfalls of making investment decisions out of either fear or greed? And that's the theory. Then you have to have some practicum to make it work.
Well, I mean, the first thing you should ask yourself anytime there's a crisis or there's a market sell-off, what has changed? Does what is going on in the market match rationally what is going on in the economy? And as I mentioned earlier in this broadcast, we've just seen the strongest housing numbers that we've seen since 2006. We've seen the strongest automobile sales, four back-to-back months of automobile sales at a run rate of over 17 million, something we haven't seen since the last decade. Retail is strong. The ISM service sector is going strong. So that's not matching with what we're fearful of this economy, and especially with the Fed maybe possibly raising interest rates. Secondly, know what it is that you own and why you own it. I mean, if you own Exxon or you own, I don't know, Johnson & Johnson or Coca-Cola, is Coke still selling Coke around the world? Is Exxon still selling gasoline? Is Johnson & Johnson still selling Band-Aids, drugs, and the other things that they do? So know what it is you own and why you own it. Then think about the tax consequences of you sell. Weigh the actual taxes you're going to end up paying and owing to the government versus a temporary downturn in market value in your portfolio. The downturn in market value could be temporary. The taxes you're going to end up paying as a result of selling are going to be permanent. And the other aspect is understand what will happen to your income if you retire. If you're getting income, I don't care if it's from bonds, if it's from dividends, from stocks, all of a sudden you go to cash, what's going to happen to your income? How are you going to support yourself? Because if you go to cash, you're going to end up spending your principal to live on because you're not getting that income anymore. And also think about, you know, the companies you own. If you own a good, high-quality company, I don't care if it's Coke, if it's Exxon, if it's Johnson & Johnson, whatever it is, if it's a good blue-chip company, it's blue-chip for a reason. They've been around a long time. They have strong balance sheets. They have a strong business franchise. If the market goes down in the last 2 weeks, is your dividend from Coca-Cola going to change? No. You're still going to get it. And more likely, it's going to go up again when the annual shareholders meeting and the board of directors vote to raise the dividend again. So your income stays the same. And that's, I think, one of the misleading myths about these market corrections. People think a stock price has fallen, they think their income's going to fall, which is just the opposite. If you own Coca-Cola, you're still going to get your dividend. And more likely, it'll be raised every year by 7-8%. And quite honestly, John, I know very few people in the job force that are getting 7-8% pay increases each year.
Oh, well, if you're still nervous and you do all these things, then what?
Well, ask yourself if you're suited to manage money or do you need help? And if you do need help, then hire a professional to help you. But the last thing you want to do is watch television and let the media get you worked up into a state of fear, or read some newsletter guy that's either trying to sell you a newsletter or sell you gold or, I don't know, food for your bunker or, you know, whatever it is, the end of the world stuff that these guys push and sell to people, and they push fear. So if you find yourself reacting to that, it's very harmful to your financial well-being.
Yeah, and just so people know, though, we've talked here on the program about the need for emergency preparedness as well. In other words, so there's a struck balance between there. You're not preparing for the end of the world, but you are preparing for disasters when they come, you know. At one point, Jim, I recognized that I needed help, so I went into radio, and it seemed to have solved the problem.
Yeah. You became part of the problem in the media, huh?
Yes, I did. Anyway, well, you know, the most important thing, though, is when I need advice. I remember, speaking of radio, when I got into radio back in 1965, you could literally know everything. You can know the technical side. You can know everything there was about mixing and repairing things. Today, it is so specialized that when I need information in one area of broadcasting, I have to call friends of mine in the industry, or when we're doing videos, I have to say, who knows something about this? And I have to call that person. The same thing applies in financial areas. Talk to people who know what they're talking about, who have a good track record. So that's important. Now, I know you were influenced greatly by Benjamin Graham and also by Warren Buffett. And you recommend that people follow them and see the strategies that they used and apply the same strategies.
You know, the best book I ever read on investing was called The Intelligent Investor. In fact, it's one of the most influential books that Warren Buffett credits his career to. And I would recommend listening to this program. If you're investing, get a copy. It's a classic. I reread it every single year. There's always some investment nugget I always pick up, and it helps keep me grounded. And in my opinion, John, it belongs in every investor's library because it teaches you how to become an investor versus a speculator. And finally, sometimes you just need to take a step back, take a deep breath, turn off the TV, go hug your wife, kick a soccer ball, play golf, go to the beach, and step back from the ledge, and I think you're going to find it healthier. I mean, think of the worries that we had 2 months ago. We were all worried about Greece. That was going to bring down the economy. Now, today, we're worried about China. And before Greece, it was Ebola. Before that, it was the taper. I mean, there's always something the market worries about. And if you spend all your time worrying about the current event of the day, you are going to make wrong decisions. And I think in this modern world that we live in, we've lost touch with the art of investing. I mean, when I got started, dollar cost averaging, most people were investing in mutual funds. You put money into a mutual fund every month, and when the market corrected, the money you put in that month bought you more shares of the mutual fund. And really, when you got to retirement, all you cared about is how many shares you owned, not where the market is. And it was all about accumulating. So when prices went down, you got more shares. And, you know, I just think of a good example. A couple of years ago, Warren Buffett made an investment in Phillips 66. And it was just announced this week that he increased his position in Phillips 66 to 11%. So even during all these crises, whether it was Ebola, whether it was Greece, or whether it was now China, Buffett was buying and increased his stake. And no wonder, cheaper gasoline prices mean the refining margins on refiners has gotten bigger, the crack spread. They're making more money. And so what Buffett does is he uses these opportunities when markets go down to accumulate more shares in the companies he's buying. And the other thing that he's also known for is minimization. He just did a special transaction regarding Phillips that was done on a tax basis that was more favorable to Berkshire. So Buffett pays hardly a small fraction of his income in taxes, and he very seldom pays capital gains. And that's one of the reasons he's the second richest man in the world. The guy's worth over $71 billion. Not bad, with starting with $10,000 as an investor back in the 60s. So, you know, if you take a look at the way our economic system works in this country, it's capitalistic. America does well versus other countries because we are more of a private sector driven economy. Now, that's changing a little bit under Obama, but still the system rewards stock investment by lower tax rates and superior long-term returns. And that's something I think that you have to keep in mind when you're investing, and especially if you're in retirement. You can't afford to make financial decisions based on an emotional reaction to news. It's very damaging long-term to your financial health.
All right, well, summing all of this up, I would say when I talked about checklists, they're very useful, by the way, in emergencies, because you just simply go down the checklist, you know you got everything covered because you thought it out in a calm period rather than when things are pressing upon you. But it works the same way in finances. So number one, develop an investment philosophy. Number two, know what you own and why. So three, when stuff starts to go rumble in the markets, ask yourself what has changed. 4, before taking any action, thinking to save yourself from that, think about the tax consequences of selling and understand how selling impacts your income. 5, sometimes it's just best to turn off the TV. 6, all right, let's say you've ignored 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and you decide to sell. What are you going to do next? Because you have to replace. It's not just enough to undo yourself from one thing. You have to figure out what you're going to do to replace it with after you sell. What are you going to buy? And 7, ask yourself, will you ever get back in to what you are leaving? This is important to understand these cycles and how they affect what you're doing. 8, are you smart enough to see the bottom to get back in? And 9, do yourself a favor. If failing all of that, you know, there is no lack of substitute for wise advice. Get professional advice. But you have to remember, a lot of times economic theories are like theological disputes and theories are philosophical ones. Everybody's got a theory. Who are the guys that knew what they were talking about? Who are the ones who seem to have a good track record? That's important. Time to go to our real life case study. It's what we do every week here on Lifetime Income. These are real world events. We simply change the names of the people involved to protect their privacy. And they are usually real world examples of exactly what we have been discussing. So who are the people this week, Jim?
This week's case study, we'll call Bill and Barbara Smith. They've been clients of ours since the late 80s. Bill just recently passed away at the age of 91. Johnny was a well-known artist known for his desert landscapes. He first became a client of ours in the late 80s. And basically, I had the good event of taking him out of an investment scheme that later turned out to be a Ponzi scheme. The firm that he had his money with, we got him out of the investment. And this was something very similar to what Bernie Madoff was doing and some of the scandals you've read about. You know, he had roughly about $500,000 of his pension fund with this company. And I was looking at the statements. He couldn't understand them, but every single month, his account went up a little over 1.5%. And, you know, you think of the market gyrations. We even had them in the 80s. We had them in 84, had the big one in 87. But every single month, his account went up 1.5%. I said, I don't know what this investment is, but no investment goes up at 1.5%. We tried to talk to the company, and we tried to transfer the money to our firm. It took us about 4 months to do that, but we eventually got it. Now, a year later, they were later busted by the SEC for running a Ponzi scheme. And basically, you know, if that was to occur today, they have something called the clawback. So let's say, for example, if you were with Bernie Madoff and your advisor got you out of Madoff's fund a year before it was busted, you would have to give that money back. So they call them clawbacks. Back then, they didn't have them. But anyway, we got him out of this Ponzi scheme, and we put together a financial plan. We set up a defined benefit pension plan for him. He had a lot of deferred assets in his account. He had put a lot of money in an annuity, and then, of course, his pension plan. We set up a trust and what we call a last survivor policy to handle the income taxes and estate taxes on his estate.
Now, I would assume that they're very successful if they were actually buying insurance to pay the taxes. Probably shrewd as well.
Well, I mean, he was a very successful artist, but, you know, you have to go back to the 80s at the time this plan was originally put into effect, because when Ronald Reagan came in as president, he raised the exemption from $175,000 to $600,000. So with a living trust, you could shelter twice that, or $1.2 million. So basically back then, anything over $1.2 million was taxed at over 50%. So he did have an income tax problem on his pension and his annuity, and he had over the $1.2 million, so there were estate taxes. And not only that, he continued to work because we set up a defined benefit pension plan, which he continued to contribute. So the income tax would only get bigger. Now, eventually, he moved out of California to Texas. Couple reasons. He had kids there, lower taxes. I mean, there's no state income taxes in the state of Texas. The cost of housing is a lot cheaper there. And also, he began to slow down. And unfortunately, as a painter, he developed arthritis in his hands, so it limited what he could do. Now, about 4 years ago, He began to develop health issues. He passed away at age 91, so he was in his late 80s. And 2 years ago, his wife Barbara was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. So we had a family meeting with the kids, and they wanted to stay at home. There were four kids. The oldest son was a retired Air Force colonel. He became the main trustee on the trust. And the youngest daughter was single, and she began to take care of mom and dad. And they wanted to stay at home. They didn't want to go into a long-term care facility. Well, about 3 months ago, Bill's health really took a downturn and really began to deteriorate rapidly. So what we had to do, John, is we updated the estate plan. He wanted to make sure there were special provisions to take care of his single daughter who was taking care of them. So she had been doing this for a couple of years, and he wanted to make sure that she was going to be rewarded for that, because that's what she was doing. He also wanted to make sure that he could take care of not only his wife, but we also changed the distribution requirements or the beneficiary provisions on his IRA, which was the rollover of his pension plan, and also the annuity. So about two-thirds of his assets were basically in his IRA and his annuity, and about one-third was in real estate and cash reserves. Now, we still had the $800,000 life insurance policy. Now, the IRA and the annuity, we put in stretch provisions, and this did a couple things. Rather than having all those gains taxed at ordinary income in the year of death, let's say in this case Barbara, who is now the survivor, the proceeds would go to each kid in equal shares and be taken out over their lifetime, which would minimize the income taxes on the accumulated buildup, but also it would be taxed at the kids' bracket rather than a lump sum being taxed at the higher rate. There was a provision made with the consent of the three other children that the real estate, which was basically their home, would go directly to their one daughter, and the proceeds of the life insurance would go into a trust that would produce income for the beneficiaries, especially with the oldest son who was trustee. So here was a plan, John, that began in the 1980s. It evolved over time through the course of their retirement as their assets grew and got larger. And then also towards the final end when they were running into more serious medical issues with Bob's health, and then also now with Barbara, who has Alzheimer's.
Well, it sounds like the plan actually evolved over time, which is good, because you have a plan. And then if you really do need to do some restructuring, you can do that, especially to reflect, say, for example, changes in tax laws and other financial circumstances. And it sounds like even towards the end, they were actually still updating the plan. So it was a living plan.
Yeah, because, I mean, Bill wanted to make sure his wife was taken care of. He wanted to make sure his daughter was rewarded for taking care of not only himself, but his wife. And he wanted to make sure the money was locked up to make sure the youngest son wouldn't blow his inheritance. He wasn't as financially responsible as the other three children. And Bill knew his children, and he made sure they were well taken care of. His oldest son, coming out of the military, was a quick study in financial planning. He made a great trustee, taking care of his parents when they could no longer function as their own trustee, especially with Barbara's Alzheimer's and then Bill's deteriorating health.
Well, the best part of this is that he did have a plan, and that the plan was updated as circumstances changed. But in times of chaos, you know, when things do what they do last over the last couple of weeks, that acts as a buffer. He has a reference point to judge what everything else is happening and to either do or don't do certain things. So that's important. It can change when real circumstances demand it, but it also acts as a buffer against those flips and flops that the markets always go through. Things are up and down and cyclical and affected by psychology and technicals and you name it. Coming up next, Yolanda York speaking to us about very important changes in Social Security and Medicare for people who are receiving benefits or not receiving them. This is important. Coming up next as Lifetime Income continues at FinancialSense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his Lifetime Income Specialists, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Mm-hmm. Well, there could be some important changes coming to Medicare. If not fixed, certain seniors could see their Medicare premiums go up 52%. Joining me on the program is Yolanda York from Social Security. Yolanda, let's see if we could just tell our listeners some of the basic things that are coming into play. It's my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, that under Social Security and Medicare rules, there's what is called a hold harmless provision. It's a special rule that's intended to protect most Social Security recipients from experiencing a decrease in their benefit payments. Now, it does this by limiting the dollar amount of the annual Medicare Part B premium increase to the dollar amount of the Social Security's cost of living adjustment. In other words, as a result of an increase in Medicare premiums, you wouldn't lose benefit. In other words, it would be a net-net. But I understand that this is only going to affect those individuals who are required to get Part B, let's say at age 65, somebody like myself, and is not taking Social Security benefits. Did I get this right?
Yes, you did.
Now, I would suspect anytime somebody gets a 52% increase in cost, I suspect somebody on the congressional side is going to try to do something to fix that.
I agree. I agree with you correctly. And so this is, like you stated, it is happening in the media. I would definitely advise people to stay tuned as to what's going to happen with this premium. One of the things that I would highly recommend is people visit the socialsecurity.gov website, sign up for the e-news. Because then you will know how is this going to be modified, what changes will take place. Centers on Medicare and Medicaid services, they're probably going to be the ones that come on and advise us as to what the future of this, what the fix will be.
And until there's a fix, this is scheduled to go into effect January 1st?
That I don't even know. All I know is that what I'm reading and you're reading and most of us are reading is that this is effective 2016. Is it January 1st? I haven't seen that anywhere in the news yet.
Okay. Well, let's cover a couple basic things here, because it's my understanding 3 months prior to turning age 65, you should go to socialsecurity.gov and register for Medicare. Let's talk about what the rules are, how this can be done online and done very easily, and what are the implications? In other words, what do our listeners need to know?
So, to file for Medicare, yes. You can apply at socialsecurity.gov 3 months before you become 65. It takes 12 minutes to file your application online. If you were born in this country, we probably have your birth certificate, so you won't have to submit that evidence. Now you sign up for Medicare Part A, which is hospital. Part B is the medical part that pays for your doctor bills, which is 80%. And then the premium will be withheld. If you are receiving Social Security benefits, you don't have to bother applying for Medicare, because if you started, let's say, at 62 collecting Social Security benefits, we know that your birthday's coming up. We will send you that Medicare card automatically and withhold the premium from your monthly Social Security benefit.
So if you're already receiving Social Security, let's say you made the election to take it early at age 62, the Medicare sign-up is automatic and you'll get that card?
Correct.
Okay. Now, what about a situation, Yolanda, where, let's say, take someone like myself. We have a medical program here at work that covers myself and my employees. Am I required to register at age 65 if I'm a participant in a current medical program?
The answer is no. So if you continue to work at 65 and beyond, and you're currently covered by a group health plan insurance, and there's several individuals in that same plan, you do not need to sign up for Medicare Part A or B or D. Do not need to do that. But when you terminate employment, and Jim, let's just say at 73 years of age, you finally decide, okay, I'm retiring. What you would do then is sign up with Social Security for Medicare at, let's say, 73, just as an example. You bring a letter from your employer stating that you've had health insurance, a group health coverage from 65 to the present, and then Medicare will enroll you without a penalty and without a gap. But you need to bring a letter from your employer that you've been covered by them. Another exception could be, well, let's say maybe you retire from employment today at 65, but you have a young spouse that continues to work and give you the medical health insurance coverage through their plan. That would be another exception. for not enrolling into Medicare Part A and B if you become 65. But the moment your spouse terminates employment, same scenario. You need to get a letter from your spouse's human resource manager stating that you, the individual, have been covered by their group health plan from 65 to the present.
Well, I would suspect individuals like myself that are getting close to age 65 that, you know, I know the premiums that I would pay in Medicare would be a lot cheaper than what I'm paying as part of being in a private insurance program. So it seems to me like there would be some advantages. What are some of the disadvantages of signing up early, if there are any? I know in my case, Medicare is cheaper.
Okay, well, generally, the Part B, the monthly premium for the Part B, which covers your doctor portion, which is 80% of the cost, the standard premium for 2015 is $104.90. But that's for an individual with an adjusted gross income of under $85,000 or less. Or a couple, if you're at $170,000 adjusted gross income, then that would be your premium, $104. But let's say you are married and your adjusted gross income is somewhere between $320,000 to $428,000. Then your Medicare premium would be $272.70 per person if you were of eligibility for Medicare. So that would be maybe the only thing that I could think. What's the most beneficial, the Medicare premium or what you pay at work under a group health insurance employer? And actually, I'm glad you're raising that because that's something that people really need to question. You know, what am I better off? Which is the best advantageous plan for me? Is it Medicare? Maybe Medicare is now more advantageous, or should I continue under my employer's group health plan?
Yeah, because that's basically, I know in my own case, we took a look at the premium savings. And of course, obviously, if they don't get this 52% increase in January, the savings would be less. But even then, they're substantial, almost to the point of $1,000 a month. So that's something that I would encourage any of you listening to this program. If you are covered by a health insurance program at work, take a look at if you have to pay part of that, or you're an employer, let's say, and you are paying into the premiums, take a look at what it would be under Medicare with, let's say, a supplemental insurance program. So, Yolanda, there's two things I want to bring up here. Number one, if you are working and covered under a existing health insurance program with your employer, you do not have to file for Medicare at age 65. However, when you terminate work, whether that's age 67, 70, or in the case you mentioned 73, if you then terminate employment, you would need to have a letter saying that you were covered by a health insurance program during those years of employment, that you weren't signed up for Medicare. The interesting thing, some of the analysis on this 52% increase is it may be beneficial for some individuals to, for example, apply for Social Security a year early if this 52% increase in Medicare Part premiums go into effect in January. But right now, we do know that Congress is looking into this, and it is something that I'm sure next year is an election year, and I don't think they'd like to see premiums go up 52%. That might make a few angry voters. I want to move on to Social Security. Because, Yolanda, I see so many mistakes that are made from a financial planning perspective. You know, you can claim your benefits as early as age 62, but you're not going to get your full benefits if you do. There are other situations where, let's say, for example, you might have had the husband was the main breadwinner. He paid into Social Security. The wife was a stay-at-home mom, or maybe she didn't have enough credits paid into Social Security. There's a way that she could get half of the benefits of the individual, let's say the husband, who was the main worker in the family, but let's say he didn't need the income, he could do something, file for Social Security, his wife gets half of that, and then he suspends and allows his to grow at 8% a year. Let's talk about some of the options that are available to individuals when it comes to electing Social Security, because it's very important, because once you make the election, for the most part, unless you pay it back, if you figured you made a mistake, it's permanent.
Absolutely. So I would highly recommend that every one of your listeners downloads the publication, What Every Woman Should Know. So if you've ever been married, you need to download this publication, Whatever Woman Should Know, from socialsecurity.gov. And you're going to read page 13 and 14. And Jim, what you just spoke about maximizing or filing under my spouse versus my own, that information is listed there. So let's just give you a quick scenario. You have a woman who never worked a day in her life. Basically, she was a house worker. She worked harder than any of us. If you stay at home, we know that's a lot of work. But let's say she doesn't have enough credit on her own Social Security. The husband is 66. He wants to wait till 70 to start collecting Social Security. So what he will do, he will file and suspend to entitle his wife to get 37% of his unreduced rate. So now the wife is receiving benefits under his record. He, at 70, then starts collecting 132% because, as you said, we will pay you 8% for every year you delay after full retirement age.
And why that's very important, I'd like to point out to listeners, is let's take this situation you just mentioned. The husband files at age 66. He doesn't need it, so he suspends, meaning that his Social Security will grow at 8% a year until age 70, and then his wife gets half of his Social Security. Now, by allowing his Social Security to grow to 132% benefit age 70, the reason this is important is typically women outlive men. Statistically, we know that to be a fact. So that, let's say at age 70, now he's getting 132% of his benefit. Let's say he lives to age 76, he passes on. Now his wife would have the election to either stay with half of hers, take hers originally if she allowed hers to suspend, or take her husband's, which is larger.
Which is so she, the widow, gets to inherit those delayed retirement credits. But let me make a correction. A spouse can only take 50% at full retirement age. So that means both spouses would have to be at least 66. Because if the spouse takes it at 62, then she gets 37%, not 50%.
Okay, so 37% if she took it early at age 62, 50% of the benefits at age 66. I keep thinking of my own wife because we're the same age.
So if you're both the same age, wow, what a way to maximize. So let's just talk about both spouses are the same age. And now, no, you know, they offer this to the same-sex marriages. So you are both 66, so you could say, I'm going to hold off until 70. In the meantime, your wife is 66 or full retirement age. She files, gets 50% on your record, and she delays hers until 70. So when she becomes 70, which is over her own Social Security number, and gets 132%, you also get 132%. So it's a win-win situation for your household. In the meantime, you got 48 months worth of benefits. The household received 48 months because 66 to 70, I believe that's 48 months. So that's income that you didn't know you could start receiving, and it doesn't affect anybody's record.
So in my case, where both my wife and I are the same age, I could file at age 66, suspend. She could file on her Social Security and suspend and then get 50% of mine.
Exactly. And again, that information is in what every woman should know, socialsecurity.gov. This is really, really great information to know, to be aware that, hey, there's a possibility, you know, this could be in your household. Usually some of the conversations that I've had with individuals in the last just 3 weeks, it's been like $52,000 that household is going to get for those 48 months because they just realized, oh, that could be our situation. You know, they filed.
And you know, Yolanda, when you think about it, let's say in our case where we're both the same age, 132% of our benefit at age 70 for both of us, that becomes a significant amount of money.
Huge. That's over $6,000 for most people, you know, that I've been working lately. Yeah, when you let your money grow, it could grow to about $6,000. One more thing I want to share. I don't know how much time we have, but here's another scenario that happened last week. The husband is 66 years of age, and he is definitely waiting till 70 to get 132. The wife is 62. She just filed her claim, and she's getting $1,900 a month. So the husband, because he's over 66, he's entitled to get 50% of that, which is $950. So he filed his claim at 66, and then at 70, he's going to switch over to his own and get 132. So in the meantime, $950 times 48 months.
That's a lot of money. There's really so much to learn. Now, you have this publication, What Every Woman Should Know About Social Security. Let's talk about us guys. because a lot of times, the guys make the decision, and sometimes it's not the best decision. So, is there a publication that, how about what every man should know?
Well, we call it Understanding the Benefits, Jim, and it's also on the website. So I'm so glad you brought it up. It's called Understanding the Benefits. It gives you a good briefing on all the programs Social Security offers. But again, you know, reading page 13 and 14 from this other publication, if you've ever been married, this applies to you. Even if you're single now, it's very, very clear to know. You know, ways to maximize claim now, claim later, suspend.
And Yolanda, let's cover something else that we see in today's society where, let's say, you might have been married to somebody for a long period of time. Let's say somebody successful, but unfortunately, the marriage ended in divorce. You are single now, or you get remarried. Let's talk about some of the implications for, let's say, a second marriage or, let's say, a single woman.
I would say it's options, not implications. Options, because if you've ever been married and the marriage terminated in divorce, and if the marriage lasted for more than 10 years, then you want to check and see if you could qualify for benefits under that previous spouse.
And is there a time limit for that?
No time limit.
In terms of the years married?
Yes, 10-year marriage duration.
So let's take a hypothetical. I'm a woman. I'm age 40. I marry a gentleman. We stay married for 10 years. At age 50, it ends in divorce. He just happens to be an older gentleman. 5-10 years go along. Now he's age 66. The woman is age 56. He files for Social Security. What should that woman know when it comes to her Social Security age?
Well, first of all, that person would need to be of eligibility 8 years. So you start at 62 as the earliest. So at 62, she would be entitled to either get 37% from this gentleman, or if she was to wait till full retirement age, then it would be, you know, that 50%. And so, and if he died, then obviously she's getting 100% of whatever he was eligible.
And would that still apply if, let's say, he died before she turned age 62, she waits to age 62, he's passed on, she could get 100% of his benefit at that time?
Yeah, everything changes. When you become a widow, the benefit gets greater. So at 62, she would now get 82%. If she waited till full retirement age, she gets 100%. And pardon me, I didn't say that a widow can get it as early as age 60, and that's 71% at age 60.
And all of this, Yolanda, is covered in What Every Woman Should Know?
It is. It is. I just want to sell this book because, I mean, first of all, it's free, obviously, but people, women and men just need to know about this. We get so confused. I mean, I know a person trying to file for retirement. You know, you get to that day and you're trying to figure out, should I take it on mine? Should I take it on my spouse? Or is there any spouses out there I should take it? You want to read this book because this will help you maximize your benefits. And I would say to everyone, listen, please educate yourself about the benefits that Social Security administers, because it may just pay you well to have a conversation with one of our agents and say, look, here's my scenario. What do you think I should do?
So there's two key benefits. Ladies, if you're listening to this program with your husband, please go to socialsecurity.gov and download that program. And that program is pretty easy to find on the website.
The book.
And men, if you're listening to this program, get the publication, Everything You Want to Know About Social Security, because guys, in many cases, you're making that decision. So the more that you know what your options are and what the options are for your wife, and then there's even programs out there on how to maximize benefits. We've been discussing a number of them here. Anything else that you would like our listeners to be made aware of, Yolanda?
Absolutely. If you haven't done so yet, I would say create a My Social Security account on our website. This is definitely a high priority for everyone that has a Social Security number. If you're 18 years of age, you want to create a My Social Security. Find out how many years you've worked and paid into Social Security, because in the end, we take the high 35 years of your lifetime earnings, drop the lowest 5, and if there's any years missing on your record, this will greatly reduce your monthly benefit. So right now, if you can open up the My Social Security, verify that all the years you work are correctly posted, perfect. If you see a missing year, bring us your W-2, your last pay stub, or your tax return. We will give you the credit. If you happen to notice that there's a year there that makes no sense because you didn't earn that extra income that may be posted, let Social Security know. That probably means someone's using your number, so you need to make sure that we correct that for you. And it also will help you in deciding what your monthly benefit will be by using the retirement estimator. Now you know the solid Social Security monthly benefit you can expect at any given age. So play with the retirement estimator.
Yolanda, as we close, once again, we want to mention SocialSecurity.gov. I go to it so often, I've got it memorized. SocialSecurity.gov. And really, ladies, really download the publication, What Every Woman Should Know About Social Security. I don't care if you're a widow, you are a single parent, or you're married. Everything you need to know on how to maximize those benefits are stated clearly in that publication. And Yolanda, once again, the title of the one that the guys should read first?
Understanding the Benefits.
Okay, guys, you heard it. Understanding the Benefits. And we just told you a couple examples here. I just gave you the one in my own case. My wife and I are the same age. We could file and suspend our Social Security, which means it'll grow to 132% for both of us, but yet my wife could get 50% of my benefit. So there's so many ways that you could do to maximize your benefits that can make a tremendous difference in your life in retirement, and especially in this age of volatile stock markets and also low interest rates. Wouldn't it be nice to see your Social Security benefit grow at 8% a year and learn how to maximize those benefits. Yolanda, as always, thanks for joining us on the program and keeping us up to date. I want to wish you well, and please come back and talk to us again.
Oh, Jim, thank you so much for the invitation. I always look forward to speaking in your program. So have a great day and happy Labor Day, huh?
Okay, same to you. Take care.
You know, when you realize that, 30% of seniors are standing at risk right now of having their premiums, Part B Medicare, going up 52%, Jim, in January. Remember, next year is an election year. They'd better fix this.
I would say so. You remember, when was it? It was 1993 when President Clinton passed his tax increase that raised the amount of Social Security subject to taxation from 50 to 85%. And that election year, not only because of the tax increases, but the Democrats lost control of Congress. So I suspect somebody on the committee somewhere is going to try to fix this one. But folks, you heard about it. If you are filing for Medicare age 65 and you are going to wait age 66 to get your Social Security benefits, or you're going to file and suspend those benefits and allow them to grow at 8%, as it stands right now, unless they fix this, if you are filing for Medicare but not taking Social Security, your Part B premiums are going to rise 52%. So if you're in the upper income bracket, they'll go from $335 to $510 a month. So let's hope, write to your congressman, that they fix this. But Medicare needs to increase revenues by 25%. Unfortunately, the way the law is structured with the hold harmless provisions of Social Security, it's only those who are not receiving Social Security that would have to pay for that 25% increase in revenues, which would mean a 52% pay hike. Talk about inflation. Before we end here, please do yourself a favor, because we see this in planning. A lot of times you make these decisions on Social Security. There's so many ways that you could be maximizing your benefit. Please go to socialsecurity.gov, download the program. If you're a woman, if you are a single parent, you're married, you're a widower, please download What Every Woman Needs to Know About Social Security. And if you're a guy, download the document, Understanding Your Benefits. Please, I implore you to take the time to understand these benefits. There are so many mistakes in this age where you have markets that are unsettling and you have 0% interest rates. The difference in income to your retirement could be substantial. I want to emphasize that word, substantial. So please understand that, or talk to somebody that's qualified that knows how to maximize these benefits when you're doing your financial plan. In the meantime, we've run out of time. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, well, we hope you have a pleasant week.
can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.